and welcome. My name's Sarah Pascoe. This is the Sex Power Money podcast. Today, I'm going to be talking to Julia Schonstadt. She's from Berlin. She's an award-winning portrait photographer and video director. She studied photography design at Berlin's iconic, excuse my accent, Litverin, and sorry, I'm laughing at how bad my pronunciation of foreign words is. Litverin, and earned a master's in photography at the renowned Goldsmiths, University of London. I can pronounce those words. She's got several scholarships under her belt. She's now based in London, working between Germany and the UK. Her 16 Bars project is a critical examination of the penal system in Germany and was recognised and awarded by The Guardian in 2014. Subsequently, in 2015, a book was published on the same topic by German publisher, Asser Verlag. In her highly stylized work, she always seeks to explore the dynamic between composition and beauty in the worlds she creates. Her work in feminist adult cinema, which is what we're mostly talking about today, is an expedition into this new genre, fusioning her background of music and video with erotic film. So I wanted to know, first of all, about you, your background, how you got into making the work that you make. So tell me the whole story.
Okay, so I guess whenever people ask me how I got started in adult film specifically, I feel the need to say that I don't actually see myself as an adult filmmaker per se. You know, it really sits in with all the other work that I do, you know, as a creative or as a photographer and as a director. And on the surface, I suppose it might look like very different work, but the philosophy behind it is actually very much the same for a lot of the work that I do. And adult film is really not so different from that because, you know, besides the commercial work that I do, I've also always worked on projects that are more driven by a personal mission, if you will, you know, and that's trying to give people a voice, I suppose, who might not be in a position to really make their voices heard by a larger audience, you know, and that a lot of times is people who find themselves on the margins of society, you know, and whether that's prisoners or refugees or sex workers, that doesn't really make so much difference to me. So making adult film as an industry a safer environment for women to work in, for me, was my motivation, you know, and obviously adult film being, you know, having film as a medium at its core, I obviously had very different tools available to me to go in and try to really create an alternative, you know, whereas when I was looking at the penal system, for example, I can only look at it from the outside, really, because obviously I'm not a social worker or a psychologist, you know, so I just had different tools available, and that's what I felt it was almost my, you know, a duty as a woman and as a filmmaker to do, really. Yeah.
So in terms of like photography and filmmaking in general, did you always know that that's what you wanted to do?
No, I can't say I was that person who had their first camera at the age of six. And that was, you know, my calling from early childhood. And it actually came quite late to me. Photography wasn't on my radar until I was like 20, 21 or so. And when I first moved to London, my flatmate at the time, she was studying photography. And I always knew what I didn't want. And I always felt that I needed some sort of creative outlet, but I hadn't really found my medium, my tools, you know. Yeah. And when I came across photography, though, like it was an instant hit, you know, I knew that was it. Then I really felt that that was going to be what I wanted to dedicate my life to. Yeah. You know, so.
And when you discovered it, what you just said about wanting to tell the story or kind of provide a voice to marginalized people, did that happen quite quickly? Was it kind of straight away that you realized that's what fascinated you?
I think that's something that probably comes from me as who I am as a person and the view that I have on the world more than maybe photography as a medium, you know. And for me, it just totally made sense to merge those two together. I think at the beginning, I was actually more interested in commercial photography as a career, you know, because it can be quite difficult making a living of documentary photography or filmmaking, I suppose. But I've always felt that for a long time, I felt it was a struggle to that felt divided in, oh, do I want to, you know, dedicate my time to working commercially? But at the same time, I always felt, well, that doesn't really satisfy all the needs that I have as a human being, you know, to work with something I feel was purposeful. So, but at some point I realized I don't really have to make a decision. I can just do both, you know, and yes. That's, I think, what I've done ever since.
Yeah. Well, that seems like a very sensible decision. Like it's a trade-off, it's a compromise. And I think there are lots of people in the arts and creative industries where that is what you have to do. Like you have to make a living, but you make a living so that you can love your work and the life that you live. So it's a trade-off.
Absolutely.
So in terms of pornography, or adult content, or erotic films, what was the first thing that you made in that kind of genre?
So the first thing I made was a short film for Erica Lust for her Ex Confessions series. And for people who might not know who Erica Lust is.
Yeah, we should talk about that, because I guess in terms of, I mean, she's actually like a world famous person, like her brand. So how did you meet her? How did that happen?
Yeah, I think I was just really lucky. I obviously read about her in my research of when I first started thinking about wanting to do something in the genre. So, and at first I just reached out to her wanting to see if I can get some advice from her, you know, just asking her some questions. That was it, really. And then her team contacted me and said, well, we're actually looking for guest directors. We have this scheme where we're starting to collaborate with other directors, and whether I was interested in joining. And that's really how it happened. It was you know, just right time, right place kind of thing. And I feel like I was incredibly lucky that the very first steps I took in this direction were just, you know, supported by someone who's so experienced and just with such a great standing in the industry.
And in terms of, so it's a short film, but so was it your idea that you took to them, or was it their idea?
No, they're great. Yeah. And that's great about working with them, because they give you totally like, absolute creative freedom, and that's so great and so important as a creative as well, right? And that doesn't actually happen very often in the commercial world either.
No.
So it was an absolute joy to actually work with them. You know, you get the support framework for anything that you might need, but you also are totally free to do whatever you like. I mean, you know, you of course you've got to run your ideas by them and they approve it, but so far it's not happened that they've come back and said, no, we don't want that, you know. But yeah, they're there as much as you want them to be or need them to be, but you're very free as an artist or creative to do your thing.
So yeah, that is amazing. And you're right, it doesn't happen in the commercial world that someone just goes, hey, make something that you love. Yeah, here's all the equipment and financial support.
Yeah. Exactly. Come back with a final result.
Yeah. I mean, it must be every kind of, especially like a director, that would just be the dream to not have like notes and, the people who paid for it going, actually, we don't want that anymore. Can you do this now? So in terms of, because what's obviously quite unique as well is that usually what would happen is you would have like a writer and the director and they would kind of combine. But it seems like with you, like with your work, like the director actually kind of comes up with the story as well.
Yeah. I mean, again, on this one, I think there are different ways they are open to working on it, because Ex Confessions, actually, the concept of it is that filmmakers turn other people's fantasies into films, right? So she's got this online platform where her audience sends in their fantasies, you know, in a written way. And then you can dip into that if you like as a director and take something that you that you want to use as a, you know, as a, well, not a script, you still got to work that out yourself, but, you know, yeah. as an idea at least. But I kind of came in with my own ideas and they were happy to do that as well. Yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting. So the people who are involved, they might then see their fantasy like kind of recreated or and yeah, exactly. reinterpreted. Yeah, oh, it's very, exactly. very fascinating.
Which I think is a massive yeah. draw for the audience, you know, because it's this direct interaction with them. It's very clever, actually.
Yeah. Is everyone who works for Erica Lust, is everyone a woman or are there male directors as well?
There are male directors as well, but the majority is definitely women. Yeah. I believe maybe, I don't know, from what I know and what I've seen, there might be like five male directors or yeah. so, and I think some of them also, some of those then make gay men's porn basically.
Yeah.
So I'm not 100% sure, but I don't know if there's any men making straight films yes. on the platform. Yeah. But the majority is most definitely female.
Yeah, amazing.
And or so, non-binary.
Yeah. And so I was going to, for people listening might not kind of, they might have heard the term like feminist porn and not kind of know what it means or what the difference might be. And I thought maybe you could define that for people.
Sure. I mean, first of all, I guess there's so many different labels for this type of film that we're trying to do, right? And whether that's, whether you call it feminist porn or ethical or guilt-free, you know, to me, that doesn't really make a difference. I suppose what's important is the message behind it, right?
Mm.
And I think what unites all of us who are working in this line of work, it's the sense that something really needs to change, right? And that it's time for something to happen and something bold to happen, really. And I think the response of feminist porn is to put women into positions of responsibility and putting women in charge, you know. I always say it's not so much about the nakedness or porn even, you know, at least not only. It's much bigger than that. It's a way to empower women, you know, and put their desires and their needs at the center of what we're doing. And before objectification and bad education even begins, you know, it's tackling issues and of the industry from within, as I said earlier, you know, and confronting it head on. So and in general, I guess it's also about installing a belief in women that their desire matters, you know, and their pleasure matters, whether it's women in front of the camera or women watching it, you know. It's very much about making their voices heard and putting them at the center of it. And then of course there's also other guidelines and rules, if you will, you know, that part of the industry has kind of set itself, rightly so, that probably set them apart from a lot of the mainstream productions. And that can be things to do with consent, safe sex, you know, or fair pay. You know, those are all things yes. that I think also define that ethical adult filmmaking as well.
Yeah. So it's working practices and it's making sure that there's like I was just talking about empowerment of desire and of creation. But actually what you see on the screen might not be a completely different world away. You're not going to go, oh, I absolutely know that that's feminist porn because everyone's wearing a cardigan, or yeah, it happened in a library, so
I hope that the main difference might be visually, at least as a visual experience for the viewer, that it's more relatable, you know, it's more authentic than a lot of the content that's out there on other platforms.
Yes. And sometimes I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because when I speak to women who consume porn, like some of them find the idea of like porn for women really patronising, because when they find it on a tube site, quite often there's a level of, I guess it's like more kissing. Like, it's like, oh, so you don't want to watch, you're a woman, so you won't want to watch any sex. What we'll show you is this newly married couple on a beach. They're going to kiss for 20 minutes. You're not going to upset anyone. And that the term is something that maybe even, like, it's for male partners to introduce their female partner. They'll be like, oh, I watch porn. What kind of stuff? Oh, this is it. I just watch kissing.
Yeah, I mean, God, that sounds like that would have been an unfortunate choice of introduction to what can be or could be porn for women or by women, you know.
Yes.
But I think that part of the industry is growing so much now that if you do a bit of research, you know, I think it won't take long for you to actually find some of the good stuff that's out there as well.
So you mentioned briefly, like, kind of the problems in the industry, like the mainstream industry or the pre-existing. Could we talk a little bit about what they are? Because I think many people, including people who probably masturbate to porn on a regular basis, haven't even considered the industry or the fact that they don't pay and things like that.
Sure. I mean, I've got to say, I've never been on a mainstream porn set, you know, like I can only speak from what I've seen myself, I suppose, right? And I know there's also a lot of performers who work in the mainstream industry who have not had any bad experiences, so it's I always want to be a bit careful on you know, pointing fingers or tarring everything with the same brush, but of course there is problems, but I don't know, I always tend to look at more at what can we do different and better than looking at what's actually being done and out there, you know. And as I said, I also don't watch any of that content. You know, I know there is a lot of stuff out there that is potentially harmful for, you know, body image or, you know, especially for young people, young minds, and how they translate that probably too literal into their experience and the bedroom, you know. But I don't know, not being part of that industry, it's a bit difficult to really comment. I think there's other people who work in it who are probably better to people to speak about that. But
when you mentioned body image, especially like in terms of like young people, but I think, and I wonder if this has ever come up in your conversations with Erica Lust and all of the people that work there, is obviously male penis size is kind of, I'm not going to say it's exaggerated because they are real people, but it's such an important factor in pornography. Do you know if there's a kind of a movement or an intention to show more realistically sized men or a range of men?
Well, I would say diversity within body shapes is generally one thing that's definitely crucial and really important to at least Erica Lust, and I would also say the whole, you know, feminist side of that industry, 100%. And I would say that goes for women as much as it goes for men.
Yes.
At the same time, I only do lesbian porn, so it's not something that I'm very much involved with.
No.
But, yeah, for sure. I think it's really about showing the whole range of what is, you know, natural and just and not going for those stereotypical body images that are already out there, for sure.
When people find out what you do, and obviously you do all different kinds of work, but when people find out that as part of that range of work one of the things is to make pornographic films, what do you think they tend to expect?
I guess whenever someone whenever I have that conversation with someone, I make sure I also deliver an explanation, you know, with what it is that I do. I hardly ever just put it out there as a one-liner and say I do porn and that's it.
Yeah.
So, but yes, the initial reaction of most people at first, I can tell just from, you know, experience and what we're all kind of used to, because unless you're really, really aware and you've really done your research and or are even involved in this type of work, most people, I think, still don't really, you know, it's not the go-to yet, unfortunately. Hopefully with a bit of time it will be, but you know, the majority of people are still very much used to that image of what we know as mainstream. So yes, people are usually a bit surprised, I guess. And then there's just loads and loads of questions, you know, and they're all very curious, and especially as a woman, you know. And but I think, you know, in any good conversation, you kind of, they get it, you know, people understand. Yeah. But I'm always a bit, I am a bit careful with who I start the conversation with, that as well, I've got to say.
Yeah. I think the reason people are surprised is that anything to do with sex, because we still actually, lots of people still live quite kind of prudish existences. The surprise is that they think, oh, but you're just a regular person like me. Like, you're not dressed up in pleather with a whip in your hand. Like, how would I have known?
Yeah, totally, totally. And I think that is, that's the exciting thing about it as well, that it's working on changing that image, you know, and that stereotype. And I quite enjoy that part of the work as well. When I started, I don't think I foresaw that happening. I just kind of thought, well, I make the films and that's it, you know. But I actually do get a lot of requests by media now, you know, or by TV shows. So it's really interesting to see how this conversation is really picking up speed. And it seems that it's becoming much more acceptable or accepted to talk about it, you know, in a wider and public context. So it's great. And I think, yeah, I didn't think it, you know, I'd be sitting here talking about porn publicly so much as I do, but yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting to challenge that image, you know.
When you're making work, or even when you're like coming up with the story, do you have an idea of a viewer? So do you have like someone in mind and you go, I'm making this for you?
The viewer? No, I don't think so, to be honest. Yeah. The way I usually work is it's quite patchy in a way. Like, I might have some, you know, a loose idea, and then I also work a lot with sound and audio and music, you know, so I usually then just kind of put on some music and I just let ideas and images come to mind, you know. And I guess the way maybe that I think of the audience is in the way that, you know, a sexual fantasy can be a great fantasy as a thought concept, but then it might not translate very well on screen, you know, to make it an interesting movie. So I think in that sense, I try to include the audience in my progress of development, that in the sense that I try to think about what works on screen and as a story, you know, as a video. But also, actually, thinking about it now, because we do... because I only do girl and girl stuff, I am aware that there isn't, or historically there hasn't been that much within that genre that's really authentic and speaks to LGBT women and non-binary people, you know. So, and that was also something I was very, very aware of from the very beginning, because it's something that I've heard over years so many times in the community, you know, like women saying, lesbians saying, well, there just isn't anything that I can relate to that feels authentic to me, you know. So that's definitely a major aspiration and motivation in what I do, to create something that's believable and authentic to women who enjoy intimacy with other women.
And that's amazing, like, because there was lots of, as like, and obviously you know this, but there's so much like girl on girl porn that exists, but it never ever reflected reality for people. It was so there for heterosexual men. It was performative and unrealistic, and that must have been so frustrating for so many women.
Exactly. Totally. That's exactly the point.
In terms of the creative process, How long does it go from the kind of the pitch of the idea to the edit of the finished product? Is it a relatively quick turnover?
Well, I guess it depends what how you define quick or long.
Yes,
if we're talking in film and TV terms, it's probably relatively quick. If we're talking about video online content, it's probably relatively long. So I think it kind of sits somewhere in between the two, you know. For a 10-minute video, it is probably a long production timeline, just because, you know, there is a certain level we want to achieve with the production value, you know. So the way we go into it, and the whole team of Erica Lust, I know they wanted to have a cinematic quality, you know, that's part of the concept as well. So it definitely, you know, it deserves a certain amount of time to prep. And I think on the first one that I did, it definitely took the longest compared to the next two that followed, just because it was the first time, you know, and we didn't have any references to show, and finding crew, you know, whereas further down the line, you've worked with people and you can come back to them, you know. So the first time for the first film, I think I was also away in between on holiday, though. So I think it was something like 3 months or so, you know. Whereas the last one, I think we did in a month and a half. So, But also, sorry, one last thing, because it's so important for us to work with women behind the camera as well, you know. So we have luckily achieved to have a 90% or 95% female team on all the films that we've done, you know, which has probably taken a bit longer in production beforehand to, you know, just because it might take... Because, you know, a lot of those roles are typically filled by men. So, you know, finding a gaffer or a grip, you know, female grip wasn't so easy, but it was worth the time for sure.
Yeah. That sounds like it would be a completely different environment to work in. And then you must go to commercial work where suddenly again you're surrounded by men doing those jobs. What are the kind of noticeable differences?
I think it's just a general vibe, it's the energy in the room, you know. I couldn't even put my finger on specific things in terms, you know, to give you a specific example, but it's really the best way that I can say it. It's really the energy. It feels like it's a sense of togetherness, you know, and I don't know, that's very special, I find, to creating something that's really driven by women only. And, there's just very little mansplaining, you know, so that's pleasant. less of, you know, let me show you how it works, you know. And I think everyone is just very grateful for that kind of environment as well, because it is different. So it just feels like everyone's really out there to do their best. And then, coming back to other sets and maybe more commercial work, it does feel different again. But at the same time, I feel there's also something happening there, you know. So I actually happen to be on more and more sets in the commercial world that also, have an eye on that and also make sure there is more and more women involved. So I think there's definitely a shift happening too, which is great.
Yeah, that is really, really great. So I was going to ask you a question about finance now, because knowing how much things cost to film and make, when you say, it was a month and a half or 3 months, and with this entire crew, like, it must be a very expensive process.
Yeah, again, you know, for an adult film or for porn, you know, I think least people expect anything really that they see to cost more than, I don't know, maybe a grand, and that's probably already high, you know, that's probably already a lot with all the free content that we used to see and all the low budget, low quality and free stuff and home videos, you know. It's definitely a different experience. So Yeah, again, I think it sits in between what I said earlier, the video content and the film world. You know, it's, yeah, for porn, it's definitely a good budget to have. But, you know, as you probably know yourself, as a creator, as a filmmaker, there's always more you would like to do and could do, you know. But it's great.
And where does the money come from? So is Erica Lust has subscribers, and is that the source of income for the films?
Exactly. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure in the beginning she's also, you know, I think she started with a crowdfunding, actually. That was a very initial kickoff. After she's done one film herself, which she probably, you know, financed herself, she then saw that there's quite an interest there and got a crowdfunding going. And then she set up the subscription model that you just mentioned. And I think that's actually a really important point to talk about as well, because as consumers of porn, a lot of people aren't even aware of it, you know, and they don't understand why should they pay for the porn they watch. And that is so, so important to educate. That's what I say to people, educate yourselves, you know, who makes the porn that I'm watching, who is behind it, you know, and what are the work ethics of the people who produce the porn that I watch, because their clicks and their subscription directly drives the direction this industry is going, you know, and it also impacts the production value and the work ethics, you know. It's pretty much as simple as demand and supply, really. So I think awareness for those questions is really what consumers should think about, because it's really no different from the concept of buying slow fashion, or, you know, that fast food isn't good for you, you know. And I think that's really been kind of accepted now or understood, and I think it shouldn't be any different with porn, really.
Yeah, I think because for such a long time porn was such a shameful secret for people who were using it on a regular basis, that they then didn't have, because there was no conversation, there was also no responsibility about themselves as consumers. Like, people who consume porn, as you say, it's exactly the same as where you shop and where you eat. You have responsibility for where your, like, and your, where your money goes and where your eyes are going.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. And I think there's also something really important in what you just said, is the, you know, the shame that comes with it. It's that whole culture of shame and silence that that enables that kind of behavior and production, right? It kind of feeds into each other. It's a bit of a two-way street, right? And so I think one of the really crucial things we need is to redefine that conversation that we're having around and about sex and sexuality, right? And shift that lens from one of shame towards one that is a lot more open and doesn't fear to confront those things that might be unpleasant to talk about, right?
Yeah, or uncomfortable because people feel like their sexuality says something about them as a person.
Yeah, exactly.
So is there a problem with films being stolen? Like, as in, you guys make something, it's uploaded for a subscription service, but is there a thing where the videos can kind of be ripped and then put onto tube sites?
Yeah, I mean, with, you know, living in a digital age, I think anything that you put online is somewhat out there to, you know, if someone really wants to and puts an effort into ripping your content, they'll find a way and they will succeed, you know, in one way or another. I think that's just the, you know, something that comes with the digitalization that we live in. However, I mean, yeah, I've heard of Erica Lust films been found on tube sites, but, you know, I think the important thing here is to say, well, there's always going to be some black sheep, you know, it shouldn't stop us from, you know, doing what we do. Yeah. And hopefully the majority of people get it and will understand it and will also pay for it, you know.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, because actually there are some people who get so obsessed with theft, whether it doesn't matter if you're a musician or you make television or you make comedy. you can become so obsessed with trying to stop it happening that actually your life becomes this miserable cycle of having things taken down or trying to take people to a small claims court because they've used it. And actually, in some ways, you have to go, that's an inevitable part, isn't it, of just how things happen.
And you really got to see where you want to direct your energy towards too as well, right? Because it can, as you said, like if you take it as far as to, you know, taking someone to court, that's going to be a huge, that's going to take up a huge part of your time, energy, and maybe even money, you know. So I don't know, you've got to pick your battles.
In comedy, it happens with like tweets. So a comedian will write a funny tweet, a joke, and then what will happen is quite often, not quite often, but it happens on a daily basis that someone else will pretend it's their joke. So they will word for word and they'll get more retweets. And then and I think it's hard for the ego because that comedian thinks, well, that's my joke and it's not credited. It's so unfair. So then they'll start tweeting at the person going, that's my joke. I said it first. And then they're trying to get their people to retweet them to say more people need to see it. And there's another thing where, you know, like they do like BuzzFeed articles of like 15 funniest jokes about Brexit. Well, quite often they they will do the jokes, but they won't credit the person who wrote it.
Right.
And then people are like, I'm taking you to the small claims court, BuzzFeed. Like you're stealing people's content. But actually, it's an unwinnable war, which isn't to say that it's right or fair.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
I imagine that must be quite difficult, actually, because when we talk about words or, you know, tweets, it's, I mean, of course, that's intellectual property, but it's very less tangible, I guess, in a way than if you have a video, you know, uploaded onto a platform that clearly has a copyright on it, you know. So, God, yeah, I can only imagine that can be quite a tough battle, actually.
So, shall we talk about fantasies a little bit? Hello. Just to let you know, if you're wondering what that weird noise is in the background, don't worry, it's not in your mind. It's my husband hoovering. Because I think, because I think you'll be able to tell me so many interesting things. So when you you read people's kind of ideas for fantasies, is there anything that ever surprises you? Or do you think that now you go, no, human sexuality is this, I will never be surprised again?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think I always tend to think nothing human surprises me in a way. I think, you know, I once read something, or I think it's a bit of a thing to say, if you can think of this, porn about it, you know. But I, from what I have seen on Erica's website, at least, there's nothing on there that is, you know, pushing the boundaries of, you know, the extremes. So it's all pretty much in the realm of, you know, what you and I might be coming up with as well in a good brainstorming session.
Yes,
but it might be more a case of like, oh, yeah, I hadn't thought of that. You know, that's a good idea. More than, oh, my God, how dare you.
Yes. Yeah. So do people, because it tends to be that like power dynamics are a really interesting place for sexuality, that people like the idea of like either being, I guess, like dominated or in charge. And it's sometimes, especially in fantasy, in real life, we're quite uncomfortable with that idea. It's what we would call like quite problematic. But in fantasy, that's where you can really enjoy that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most prominent of example of that kind is probably rape fantasies, right?
Yeah.
Which we know there is women out there who enjoy that, and I always fear or always think, who am I to judge, you know, who am I to say what's right or wrong? And that's also one thing that was very clear for me in the beginning. I am not here to, you know, to be a moral compass of fantasies and what's okay for people to explore within their own bedrooms, you know. I think as long as everything's consented, anything goes, really, and you know, in a, as long as we're talking about a safe space. So if whatever floats your boat, I guess, you know, as long as, yeah, the barometers of consent and safety are given, I think it's great to explore all kinds and all chapters of sexuality.
And does there tend to be a difference between like a heterosexual fantasy and then someone's fantasy for like girl on girl?
Oh, that's a good question. I hadn't really thought about that before. Is there a difference? God, I don't really know. I'd probably have to sit with that one and read through. I couldn't actually really say off the cuff, to be honest.
So with the rape fantasy, if someone writes in with something that's a version of that, of being overpowered, is that something still you guys would make? Or would you have a policy of that's not really our area?
I couldn't say what Erica's take is on that and whether she's got any, you know, sort of policy on that. For me personally, I know it's nothing I would want to do myself, because the films that I choose to make, I want to enjoy as well, you know, and the process of making them. And a rape fantasy is just something that I don't feel very comfortable with, you know, so it's probably nothing I would choose to do and pursue. But that's not to say that there might be someone out there in the guest director's directory who might, you know. But
something you
it wouldn't be.
Something you said earlier was about some fantasies don't look great for film, and I think that might be an example of something, because a rape fantasy in someone's mind, them imagining it, is completely different to watching it, where you actually see the aggression. And
very like, true.
So I wonder if it's that, like the whole point of a fantasy of like someone fancying you so much it's overwhelming. It's like, but it wouldn't look like that from the objective outsider. You don't see the consent. You don't see the playfulness all of those things.
You're right. That is a very good point, actually. And it also, it probably, because once you take it out of the mind onto the screen, it becomes more than a thought, right? And it would be there to trigger other people as well, I suppose. So, yeah, it's probably a very good example of that.
One of my friends used to work years ago at the London Dungeons. I don't know if you've ever been there. But he was Jack the Ripper. He's like an actor dressed up as Jack the Ripper. And one day a woman ran up to him and said, "Oh, rape me, Jack, rape me." And then started kissing him.
Wow.
I know.
Oh,
and
wow.
He was telling this story and it was so crazy, because I was like, I'm really aware of like rape fantasy, and that for some women it's a really, just because it's so illicit and bad, and they absolutely do not want to be overcome or assaulted. But the idea of it, when they were in a safe space. But this woman actually like charged up to a man she didn't know. And I thought, that is such a, she's so lucky he was like this silly, effeminate man.
Yeah.
It was never going to hurt her.
That's definitely pushing it.
Isn't it? Imagine having a Jack the Ripper fantasy. And then you think, of course, that's the whole point of sexuality, is it goes to all of these like really, not unhealthy places, but dark places. It goes to...
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the only thing that I remember to have seen on Erica's platform I don't want to, you know, it's different, but it was about, if I remember, I've not actually seen the film, but I've seen, you know, the trailer or something. I know there's one about someone breaking into someone's house, and of course, somewhere down the line, they end up having sex. But I don't know what the, how the story unfolds, whether it's something forceful or whether it's, you know, she falls in love with a burglar.
Sure. Or she could have had a long chat about his life choices and how maybe he came from a background.
Possible.
And then eventually, then there's a beautiful two-way respect, and as you say, then love.
One to check out, maybe. Put on the watch list.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of like, do you think you've learned a lot about female sexuality and female desire from your work?
I would say I've definitely, it's made me more aware, for sure. It definitely has had an impact on me and my life, 100%. Because I think you can't immerse yourself in that whole world and subject matter without it making you, like, opening you up, you know. And I think it's also to do one thing, definitely body image as well, you know, for myself, and also looking inwards and outwards, you know, because obviously I've also not been an exception to growing up in that culture, you know, of shame, and also, you know, being under the influence of the imagery that's out there, being put out there by the media. Even if I work in the media, you know, it's not like I have this magical shield, you know. So it's definitely had its effect on me as well, for sure. Yeah. And I think the other thing that has probably been the greatest revelation for me, if you will, how important communication is, you know, how crucial it is to communicate needs, desires, but also concerns and problems, you know, and that in turn, I think, then will automatically lead to a much healthier and better connection with your partner, you know, or sexual partner, whatever. Yeah, 100%.
It's such a huge thing, and it's come up a lot in the conversations that I've been having in these podcasts, is that people who have any kind of work around sex have had to think about it so much more, and that communication thing is the first thing for everyone's safety, happiness, and also arousal and satisfaction. But actually, it's like everyone who just has sex, like, as a hobby, or like in their relationships, unless they've got unless they're kind of like into BDSM, or they have a kink, or they haven't had to ever learn to do that. And so actually it's like everyone's still a bit like, because they're not having conversations, they're just kind of hoping. I'm sure they like it too. I think it's all right. Yeah. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that actually also brings or highlights the importance of sex education as well, you know, because I think if we were to just be more open about it, or to make it a bigger and more important part of, you know, everyone's journey from, you know, from childhood onwards, I suppose, then we could probably, you know, that'd just be a very different, we'd have a different way of communicating, I guess. So I think it really highlights that.
And something we spoke about before, actually, was that Erica Lust wants to be more involved and to provide resources for sex education. Yeah.
Yeah. They've actually just restarted another, like, a separate organization. I'm not sure if it's a charity or what the, you know, the legal boundaries are. But yeah, it's definitely an important part of her mission and what she does. And I think everyone who works in you know, ethical adult film, what they do is they provide information to parents and for different age groups, basically. And I think that's a lot of it is just in written format, but then it's also, you know, they're looking to do educational videos as well. And that's another thing that I actually come across now a lot more as well. Like, I get regular requests from, you know, different kinds of people who are interested in putting together a video guide, some sort of, you know, tutorial, if you like, to really help that movement to advance that, for sure. Because I think the more this movement is progressing, the more aware we are becoming that we have turned our backs to that whole subject matter and the topic, you know, of sex education. And we need to become aware and notice that we have let porn take our place in a lot of places, you know, and with that, we've really left many young people alone with their questions and their concerns. And of course, they're going to turn to the internet to find answers, you know, and if we don't do that, we really got to, reckon with the harm we're doing, I suppose, and really also ask ourselves whether we want to send out that message that the most important thing about sex is the guy coming, you know, yeah. like in a lot of videos out there, it seems to be. Of course. Yeah, I think that education, sex education is really a huge part of what we do. And we also should realize that it's not just concerning teachers or parents or kids, you know, it actually reflects on all of us, and it's on all of us to talk about it and to normalize that conversation, you know. And I think only if we succeed in doing that, we'll actually be able to create an environment that will be healthy and equal for people of all genders and all sexualities and people of all colors, really. And that then will benefit not only us, but really all future generations to come.
And actually, it's interesting what you say there about like diversity in people, because so one of the things that in mainstream porn is really problematic is racial stereotypes and kind of like racial depiction. So presumably that's something that, again, with Erica Lust and the platforms, is that you're working against.
Yeah, 100%. It probably sits in direct line with, you know, body image and what we talked about earlier. Mm. It's yeah, exactly. It's about diversity and showing all shapes and colors and forms of life, basically, you know. And without exoticizing?
Exoticizing, yeah. Yeah, or fetishizing.
Fetishizing, that's a good one.
That people, exactly. Sometimes people don't realise, it wasn't, I don't know what it was, but I hadn't realised how problematic it is for white women to say that they love black guys. Like, oh, I'm so into black guys. And it's this, and I think I'd heard so many people say that. I'd heard so many like famous white comedians say stuff along those lines. And I think, and it takes someone, usually like, yeah, a black person to go, okay, here's what the problem with that status is. I think I heard a black feminist talking at an event about the fetishization of black men's male sexuality. And I was like, oh my God, like I had no idea. And that's the thing with pornography. There's so many of those tropes.
Yeah, totally. And I think we're like all of that, we're at this interesting point in time right now, I think, where, you know, this conversation is becoming much more talked about, and everyone's just kind of waking up a bit to those statements and realities, and everyone's kind of questioning things a bit more, maybe, which is a good thing. And I think I can relate to it in a sense that you know, lesbian sex might be fetishized a bit as well, by straight men as well, you know. So but I think unless you are in, you know, one of those positions yourself, it's obviously always harder to see it. So,
Well, actually, one of the kind of experiences for lesbians who are out with their partner, it happens all the time. I hear about it, or you see it on the news, where a man approaches two women who are clearly together. And because his experience of women who are together is there is a man there, or they're doing it for a man, they think they can approach, they think they can say sexual things. And they don't, they just, I mean, and obviously they're usually like aggressive about it. And that horrible thing that's something that women have to contend with in public.
Yeah. To be honest, like something very similar happened to me really not long ago, like maybe a month ago or so. And I was so shocked because I kind of felt, well, we're in 2020 and men are still thinking it would be okay, you know, to come up to two women who are so clearly there together as a couple, as you just said, you know. And there's still something that makes them think, oh, let me just invite myself here, or they're here for my sexual gratification, you know. It really kind of shocked me, because I think sometimes also living in London or being in this bubble of, you know, where you surround yourself with people who share the same values and understanding as you do, you know, when you then step out of that, or someone comes into your bubble who doesn't have that background, it can be such a bleak reminder, you know, that not the whole world is really caught up with that yet, you know. So it's gotten much better thinking back at, like, you know, growing up in the 90s or, you know, late 90s. yeah, it's definitely gotten better, but we're still not there yet.
Yeah, it's something. There is something so crazy. Like, I feel like men, some men, not all men, have like they have fetishized the penis so much, like their own and the magic of them. Like, I think for the kind of man who would approach two women, they do think there's something special about them. Like, there is this level of like of misunderstanding. Well, that's what I used to hear when I was like, as you say, like in the 90s, when you'd hear those kind of things a lot more, the kind of thing a man would say would be like, well, if you saw my dick, you'd change your mind, or all you need is a good one of these. They are so in love with their own dicks. Like, oh, it's God. That. It's yeah. like they can't imagine that they wouldn't show it to you and you'd be like, oh, wow, so beautiful.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah, I think it really goes along with, you know, it's just that whole narrative, though, that men have been, or that the world has kind of been teaching boys and girls, you know, it's so much about that male ego. Let me show you, you know, you've, as you said, like, if you have me, you'll change your mind. You know, I think it's very much a bit of too much.
Well, that's it. It's the most misguided confidence you could have, really, isn't it? Yeah. I was going to say, so in terms of anyone listening, and I'm sure some people would maybe like never have watched porn or have thought about it. Do you have any kind of, where should we send them? Where should we? So in terms of like, places to go or things to read or to find out, do you have any favorite resources for people who want to find out more?
Well, you know, I working with and for Erica and her being really the trailblazer, I would say, for that movement, I think one great place to start is definitely Erica's website. But then there's also other platforms that might be less expensive, you know, for someone who might not want to commit. I'm not quite sure what her subscription costs at the moment, but there's smaller platforms, and maybe someone out there who wants to support, you know, more indie platforms. Maybe a good thing would be to put it into, you know, into yes, the footnotes, so I can give you
okay, some yeah, links. I'll do that on the show notes then. That's what I will do, is you can tell me some platforms and people can go and have a look and explore, and that would be so brilliant. Julia, thank you so much for talking to me. I've really enjoyed this, and I thank you for educating me and everybody else about a world that sometimes seems so mysterious.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was an absolute pleasure. And thank you for also, you know, with your show and the podcast and the books that you write, you know, you bring that whole world and the questions and concerns really to a wider audience as well. So that's really, really great. So thank you.
Thanks, mate. Thank you so much to Julia Schonstad. I could have talked to her forever. I feel like there's a lot of places to send you now. Julia has sent me a list of some platforms for people to start watching ethical adult film. So I'll have all of the links to these in the show notes. It's ericalust.com, frolicme.com, so that's frolic with a C, getcheeks.com, PinkLabelTV and aortafilms.com. Also, I'd advise you to go and find out more about Julia on her website, which is www.schonstadt.com. And thank you so much to Julia. Next week, I'm going to be joined by a pole dancer, an incredible woman called Kitty Velour. See you then.